Hello, Men and Nerds. This is Caitlin Hansen. I'm coming to you from Columbus, Ohio, and the United Methodist Church for All People, as well as the By Their Strange Fruit blog. And we are hosting another Men and Nerds webcast. Tonight, we will be speaking with Jennifer Yoder, who's coming to us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Do I have that right?
That's right.
And Stephanie Kriebel, who is in Lawrence, Kansas. And we're talking to them in particular because of the really important work they're doing. They've started a organization called Into Account. And I'd love to just start off by letting you guys tell the background of that, kind of how you got started with it, and then what are your goals and aspirations? What are you trying to do?
Sure. Well, Stephanie and I have been working together for a while on different projects. In particular, my brother and I co-founded Pink Minnow, and Stephanie happened to write a little dissertation on the search for queer justice in the Mennonite Church. And so we crossed paths when she was doing some research for that. And then, Stephanie, do you want to talk about, Stephanie actually brought me into SNAP, the Survivors Network for People Abused by Priests, and that's how we started doing sexual violence advocacy together.
Yeah. So I wrote my dissertation on the sort of Mennonite LGBT justice movement. And the deeper I got into it, the more I realized how deeply entwined LGBT justice struggles were with sexual violence. I interviewed a lot of queer folks who had experiences with sexual trauma within the church. And so by the time, and you know, another thing is that at the time that I was doing the research, this the sort of re-examination of John Howard Yoder's sexual abuse was really unfolding in the Mennonite church. And so by the time I finished my PhD, I was really pretty deeply invested in fighting sexual violence in the Mennonite church in a way that was rigorously intersectional, that wasn't only white women speaking to each other, but a movement that took into account how racism, sexism, ableism, heterosexism are all forms of social marginalization that contribute to sexual violence. And I got involved with Survivors Network for those abused by priests due to a really sort of eminent peace theologian in the Mennonite church by the name of Ruth Krall. She was one of the feminists who was really instrumental in trying to bring John Howard Yoder to some modicum of justice when he was alive. And Ruth had been working with Catholics for a long time, with Catholic survivors. And so she had a vision of forming a Mennonite SNAP group, which she did. And so we have been operating as a group for, I guess, about 2 years now. And I think Jay and I started talking about Into Account when we are realizing that, like, there were certain kinds of cases that we were ending up with, working on all the time. And like cases of sexual violence at Mennonite colleges were definitely one of them. And those came to us in part because of Jay's extensive Title IX and Clery Act experience, my experience teaching college students. And so we worked on that and started to think about, okay, how can we like turn this into an organization and a service that is filling a particular need? And that's sort of how Into Account came about, with an understanding, I think, that there need to be organizations that recognize the spiritual component of sexual abuse that happens in religious contexts. And that's really what we want to be able to address.
And so maybe going back to you for a bit, Jay, what is the vision for your work with Into Account? How do you see networking churches or campuses or individuals to accomplish what you're looking for?
Yeah, so at IntoAccount, so let me kind of tease out some of the sexual violence resources there are for people in Mennonite and Anabaptist contexts. There's the SNAP, the Survivors Network for People Abused by Priests, and you can there you can find advocacy resources for anyone who has experienced sexualized violence and is trying to figure out what to do next. There's Our Stories Untold, which is a blog where people can share their stories of what they've experienced in their own context. So it's really a storytelling kind of platform. And then there's also Dove's Nest, which specializes in child sexual abuse. And then at IntoAccount, we in particular want to provide resources for holding institutions, perpetrators, and enablers accountable for violence and for harm and for cover-ups. So, you know, we're happy to support people who are doing their healing work as well, although some of the other resources are even better for that. But what we can do is provide some strategies for bringing real accountability. And we can work with survivors. So we have a couple of survivors we're working with now and help them figure out what their options are, both maybe trying to hold them accountable through community processes or in-church processes, also looking at what legal possibilities are out there. We're not lawyers, but we can help people think through those options. And then we can also do, we've done a little bit of providing resources for churches, right? I mean, the best thing that you can do to around sexual violence is to, I don't want to say think about it before it happens because it's kind of happening all of the time around us, but to think about prevention of sexual violence and to think about how you're creating a space where people can come forward with their stories all the time. So we can help churches think through, are they a welcoming space for people to bring their stories forward? Do they have good policies and practices in place? Do they have a theology around sexualized violence and abuse in their church? And you know, you can do survivor healing work through liturgy, through song, through sermons and Sunday school classes, as well as responding well to it when it comes up in your context. So we're happy to work with churches and institutions if and when they want to work with us. I think we have a little bit of a reputation sometimes of working to hold people and institutions accountable. So some folks aren't going to want to work with us right up front. That's okay. And then we can also provide services to survivors directly.
And you know, you two have an interesting opportunity in your partnership. I mean, obviously you're in two different geographic locations, you know, working in digital field. How's that working for you?
I mean, I wish we were in the same location. And
me too.
You know,
I like, own a duplex. I'm just saying, anytime you want to move here, Stephanie.
Yeah. I think it would be easier if we did, but it works really well.
Yeah.
It works really well. I mean, we just, you know, we use everything technology has to offer us. And, you know, we, as much as possible, we try to check in every day to go over our priorities for the week. I mean, as much as anything, I think like we sort of like, we have very, very different ways of getting or sort of bodies of experience that have brought us to our current expertise. Jay is like much more a product of the activist world and I'm much more a product of the academic world. And we work really well together. It is kind of frustrating to not, like sometimes I just wish we were in the same office so we could be like, okay, can we sit down and dig into this? But we Skype a lot.
Yeah.
And we watch each other eat breakfast a lot.
That's
true.
That's
just, that's kind of how it goes.
Especially positions you and your organization very well to, you know, reach multiple populations, to be able to reach out to different parts of the country in a way that you wouldn't be able to do if you were in the basin. Maybe you need a third person on the West Coast.
No, we dream of being bigger.
To dig in a little bit to church and church culture, and what ways, to what extent is church culture helpful, and in what ways might it be perpetuating some of the issues we see in the secular world?
Yeah. So, you're going to find sexualized violence everywhere. And some of the problems are the same across, or the same or similar across cultures. There's a lot of victim blaming, although it can happen in different ways. Communities kind of everywhere struggle, no matter how much we talk about it and how much, it makes its way into the media and it makes its way into articles, that the most common kinds of sexualized violence are people who know each other. No matter how much we start to really know that, there is a wall of denial that is very real to believing that anyone you know is capable of sexualized violence. And so it's extremely difficult kind of across the board for people to be ready to accept that someone they know could have committed acts of sexualized violence. And then in the Anabaptist church, kind of specifically, we have a peace theology. We're historically a peace church and have a peace theology. However, we tend to think of violence, or it's my experience that we tend to think of violence as men with guns somewhere else, right? And we don't tend to think of things that happen in our churches, our homes, our communities, among members, as real violence or as violence that counts in that same way. So I think that's one of the problems that we face as Anabaptists. And then our way of looking at forgiveness and turning the other cheek and giving people second chances and restorative justice can sometimes be misused in context of sexualized violence. It really is a specific kind of violence that, if you are not an expert and if you have not studied it, experienced it, like really immersed yourself in understanding the dynamics of sexualized violence, it is hard for people to recognize it and respond to it appropriately. So we find a lot of people responding to sexualized violence who don't fully understand what someone who perpetrates sexualized violence, how they're going to behave, what good ways of holding them accountable are, and how to be loving to them in a real way and not just aggressively nice. So those are a few of my opinions. Stephanie, what did you want to say about that?
Yeah. Well, I would add to that maybe, and this is certainly operative in a Anabaptist context, but I think more broadly in an evangelical one as well, that there's something about a purity-based sexual ethic that helps perpetuate sexualized violence. And it's very difficult. I mean, one of the things that we have struggled with a lot is how to talk about sexual violence in a way that's perceived as not political. Sexualized violence is just, it's really hard to get around that. And one of the reasons why it's really political is that when you look at a sexual ethic that is really, really based around heterosexual marriage as its touchstone, its cornerstone, it's marriage between a man and a woman is what makes sex okay. It makes it very difficult for people to talk about consent as the factor that makes a sexual encounter ethical and okay. There is, you know, there is rape and sexual abuse within the context of heterosexual marriage, and there is plenty of healthy sex outside of the context of heterosexual marriage. But an ethic that is utterly based on the idea that the only good sex happens within heterosexual marriage, overwhelmingly, and there's so much evidence to point to this, leads victims to blame themselves and not to report. We've seen this over and over again. I mean, that's one of a number of things that ethic can perpetuate. And it also sets very different standards for men and for women. It creates standards that are based on race. Like, we are most forgiving of sexual, of any sort of like sexually aggressive behavior in white men. I mean, I think our presidential election makes that about as evident as it could possibly be. You know, we just elected a white man who is a sexual predator who blames men of color constantly for being rapists. Now, like, people don't strongly associate Donald Trump with Christianity, but that kind of ethic is perpetuated in white evangelical Christianity in a big way. And we see that in the evidence of, like, when sexual violence happens in the context of churches, churches are much more likely to rally around the perpetrator than the victim. Unless the perpetrator is someone who can easily be cast out socially. If they're gay, if they're a person of color, if they're, like, socially marked in some other way. If they are particularly if they're a middle class, upper middle class, successful white man, boy, is it hard to get a church to care.
And I would say that the purity culture that Stephanie is talking about has sort of two sides, that the only kind of sex that's okay is sex in a heterosexual marriage. And then anything else is shameful, and it's all equally shameful. You know, sexual violence is shameful because it's outside of that. If it's outside of that, affairs are shameful. Premarital sex is shameful. Queer sex is shameful. It all gets cast in this same shame zone. So like Stephanie said, we're not differentiating between sexualized violence, in which there is someone who is doing harm, and there's someone who's experiencing harm and trauma and violence. We're not differentiating between that necessarily in our culture and our theology, and two consenting adults having sex that is not in the confines of heterosexual marriage. Those situations are treated as if they are the same, and as if they require the same forgiveness and apology, and, oh, it's shameful, my body got out of control with lustful sexual thoughts and activities that weren't right, and so, you know, now I pray and I promise not to do it again, and I become whole and pure again. And so that doesn't, again, that's not addressing the violence and the trauma and the deep harm that survivors of sexualized violence experience.
And
we could talk about this a lot.
Yeah, we could talk about this a lot. I mean, the other thing I would say is, like, you can see the evidence of this in a lot of different places. I mean, we could talk about the evidence for the rest of the time here, but, like, when I look at the kinds of stories that come to me that are 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, which, you know, we get those stories as well as the much more recent ones. We, like, you know, I'm hearing stories that span decades. And it is so frequent for us to hear stories, both in even like larger evangelical contexts and in specifically Mennonite contexts, of survivors being forced to apologize for the sexual violence that was perpetrated against them by people in their churches. Because, and this comes straight from a sexual purity ethic. Like, the idea is, if, okay, that sex happens outside of that ethic, the two people who are involved are equally guilty. And and you know, equally guilty, and yet often like the victim pays a much higher price than the perpetrator. So, I mean, that those stories, you start talking to Mennonites who are, you know, it like over 60, baby boomers and older, you will hear those stories. They are everywhere of, you know, someone who's like, yeah, my sister had to apologize, even though my brother was the one who raped her. You know, my mother had to apologize for leaving her husband who is sexually abusive to our children. You know, I mean, just.
And we're talking about hauled up in front of the church and made to apologize.
That's still very fresh for a lot of Mennonites, that kind of thing. And it still happens. It is not in the past. It still happens in many contexts.
And
about ideas of violence, I think that sort of action also needs to be understood as an act of violence as well.
Absolutely.
Understanding what that does to a person.
Yeah. It is violation it's being violated by your community when you've already been violated, you know, physically and sexually by a member of that community. It really compounds what has already happened.
Yeah, and there's a book that I reference a lot when I talk about this work. It's called Betrayal Bonds, and it talks about different kinds of trauma and betrayal. And it talks about spiritual violence and spiritual betrayal and spiritual trauma. Like when your spiritual community or your spiritual leader, right, who are the people who help you shape your spiritual tools, when they're also people who are responsible for the violence that you've experienced or covering it up or making you apologize, then that can block a survivor's spiritual path. Because one of the biggest questions that survivors have to answer for themselves is, why did a bad thing happen to me? And a lot of us, we use our spiritual resources, our theological framework, our church communities, and what we have learned to think about, you know, why do bad things happen and how do I get through it? And, you know, where is God in this? And if your church or your pastor or your, you know, Sunday school class or your church community is part of shaming you or covering up or supporting the perpetrator, it's a lot harder to answer that question. It's harder to draw on your spiritual tools to be able to answer the question of, why did this happen to me? Where is God in this? You know, and if you can't lean on your church community, it can cause a lot of spiritual damage to survivors of sexualized violence.
I also feel like I've observed in a couple of different circles just this, the framework of reconciliation and forgiveness used in a fairly harmful way and maybe well-intentioned, but seems to me more so than many other contexts can be really harmful in these cases. What have you seen in that regard?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to take it first, Stephanie?
Sure. This is another one both of us could talk about extensively. I mean, one of our colleagues in SNAP, Barbara Graber, who is a, you know, a veteran of this stuff. She lives in Harrisonburg, Virginia. She's in her 60s. She's someone who other survivors disclose to all the time. She's been a tremendous, tremendous figure of support for survivors in the Mennonite Church. And she will say freely, forgiveness is the F word for survivors. And I think there's, I mean, for one thing, one of the ways that we see forgiveness misused is that it's demanded of a community before people even understand what it is that they are forgiving. It becomes a way of trying to make the ugliness of what happened disappear, and it is used to silence survivors. And forgiveness is, when it comes to forgiving sexual violence, I never tell a survivor that this is something that they should aim for. I don't think that this is something that survivors need to aspire to or feel like this is like the pinnacle of their healing. We haven't seen that to be the case. And it's sort of an, it's kind of an arbitrary term. I mean, forgiveness, one really good way, I think, of understanding it is that there is, before forgiveness can happen, there's a shared understanding of what has happened that needs to be forgiven. And very few sexual violence survivors are ever going to get that from their perpetrators. You know, people who commit sexual violence tend to create pretty elaborate, you know, edifices of denial and manipulation for themselves. And, you know, what we hear from perpetrators in the church who are trying to get themselves through a forgiveness process so that they can go back to life as normal is, I'm sorry if I offended you. I'm sorry if you misunderstood my intentions. And that is not the same thing as saying, I'm sorry that I grabbed your breast. I'm sorry that I raped you. I'm sorry that I raped your child. That it's not the same thing. And very rarely do those conversations where there's a mutual recognition that, yes, a sexual violation occurred, very rarely do those happen with perpetrators of sexualized violence. And if that doesn't happen, it's basically a survivor being told, this guy doesn't recognize what he's done to you, but we demand that you say you have forgiven him so that we don't have to be inconvenienced by your pain and your anger and any feelings that you have related to that experience anymore. So I'm not saying that forgiveness is impossible, but it has been used as a weapon so much that just the word is triggering for some survivors.
Yeah, and I think there are two really big things at play. One of them is community. You know, I grew up in a small rural community in Ohio, and where everyone knew everyone. You know, everyone knew each other's business. And part of naming sexualized violence in a space like that would be that the community would be collectively sort of forced, like we were talking about, it's really hard for people to acknowledge that they might know someone capable of sexualized violence. So the community would be brought into processing and thinking, like, what does this mean that I know this guy? And they would have to do some spiritual work. And I say guy, it could be a variety of genders, but we most commonly see men as the perpetrators of sexualized violence. But they would have to cope with knowing someone who's committed sexualized violence. So then they have to think about, what does it mean? What does it mean to have them be part of the community? Now the community is broken. Do we have to choose sides? Do we have to, and it's really an uncomfortable space for community members. So part of it comes from going like, will you please just like forgive this guy? And like, can you like just come in a room and like say you're sorry and say you forgive him? And then and then it's over for all of us. We're back to normal in our community. And then I think it's partly from, I don't see us having really good conversations about our theologies around forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Is forgiveness just something that I do at home? You know, do I sit at home and go, okay, like I forgive someone who has done me harm because I need to let go of it and I need to be able to move on? Or is forgiveness something that is a process for both parties and one of them needs to be held accountable or they can't really be forgiven? Or is forgiveness a gift that someone gives to the person who's done them harm? I mean, I don't think we've had real conversations about what is forgiveness, what is reconciliation, you know, what is restoration of a relationship, what does it require? Because for me, forgiveness requires accountability, the way that I think about it. So like Stephanie's saying, it requires someone going, I understand the real harm that I've done. I am really worried about my ability to have done that kind of harm. And so I am seeking really serious professional help because there's something real broken in me that I could harm you the way that I harmed you. And, you know, if you want me to, I'll remove myself from this community so that you can continue getting spiritual care. If you want me to, I'll report, you know, I'll have my therapist write you a report about my progress. If you want me to, you know, I will make a public apology in the local newsletter. I mean, that, like, we could have a conversation about forgiveness if we saw real accountability happening on the part of people who are perpetrating sexualized violence and on the part of people who are enabling it and who are making decisions about it when they have no expertise or knowledge or the appropriate resources to do so. Then we could talk about forgiveness, but, or if we were saying like, hey, you know, it's my opinion that you doing some sort of letting go of caring about what happens would be best for you in the privacy of your own home. But it's certainly not something you have to perform for anyone else. You don't owe anyone else forgiveness. You know, those are different conversations, but when it's used, like Stephanie was talking about, when it's used to make someone apologize in front of the church, or to make someone say they're sorry in front, or say they forgive someone in front of a church so that the community can get back to work, or so that, you know, so that everyone has to stop attending to the real grief and pain and damage that was done, then it's just so harmful. It's just so harmful, and it ignores and doesn't really acknowledge the deep pain and violence and trauma.
I mean, sorry, can I add one more thing to that?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I do as part of my work for IntoAccount and for SNAP, they sort of intersect here, is I manage this website called Mennonite Abuse Prevention List. And I do, you know, I receive reports and then I research the names as they're given to me. And, you know, if the names have enough evidence attached to them, sometimes we can make them public. Anyway, what I see when I go through this documentation is like, there are actually, particularly among perpetrators who are in church leadership positions, there's a high incentive to ask for a forgiveness process. I mean, it becomes a tool of manipulation for perpetrators that churches are very susceptible to, because they're like, there's a theological value placed on forgiveness. And, you know, I mean, I recently like looked at the file of a pastor who had 2 sexual misconduct charges against him in 2 separate Mennonite conferences. And he asked for a forgiveness process in like a congregation when he knew that he was going to be moving to another congregation in another conference. And he wanted to be able to say, it was clear, his logic was really clear. He wanted to be able to say, I asked for forgiveness. I was granted forgiveness. I was redeemed. Like, my slate is clean. And he has gone on to do tremendous harm in his current position. So it's like, we can't give people the benefit of the doubt the way that we do in Mennonite churches, especially. Like we have to be rigorous about how we understand these concepts of, you know, accountability and forgiveness. We have to be more rigorous.
And just to call back to something Stephanie said earlier, if you want to see examples of what she was saying about, if you're a leader, if you're a white middle-class man in a congregation, check out that list, because it's primarily people who are exactly the kind of story she was describing that we have a really hard time holding accountable in any real way. We see over and over, we see people who engaged and some who are currently still engaging in sexually violent, predatory behavior over long periods of time because they've gone through these, I'm going to say the word accountability here, but I hate that they even use it because there's no real accountability, but they've gone through accountability or forgiveness processes at church after church, in workplace, you know, in Mennonite workplace and institutional organizations time after time after time. And that's what I think, that's one of the biggest things that we really need to think about in church contexts is, are people trained experts in recognizing and responding to sexualized violence? Because if we are not, we're putting people in danger and we're part of the problem. You know, when we agree to a forgiveness process and then pat that pastor on the back and move him on to the next conference, we are putting people in danger. You know, we are actively putting people in danger.
Yeah, speak more to this issue of lack of training, because it's come up a couple of times in our conversation. The clear opportunity and lack of infrastructure that might be there as part of what seminary process, what are the opportunities to enhance the training that we have, and where are the gaps right now?
Well, I'll start with like the historic, and we can fill in with plenty of current specifics, but I'll start with a historical perspective for Mennonites that I think kind of shines a light on why this is still so fraught. For Mennonites, a huge problem, I think, is that one of our most central and valued theologians of the 20th century was a very, very abusive, prolific sexual predator, as we know, John Howard Yoder. And the more I look at it, the more I think that Mennonites, even Mennonites who really don't know very much about John Howard Yoder, he was so central, like intellectual in the Mennonite world, as a professor in seminaries, you know, as a sort of like person who brought intellectual respectability to pacifism. He was so central that I think to some extent an entire generation of religious professionals in the Anabaptist world is still trying to sort out what it means that like the primary ethicist of their theological training was this depraved when it came to sexuality and just interpersonal relationships in general.
And he chased out a generation of women leaders, because that's who he targeted.
And he targeted women with intellectual and church leadership ambition. And that's pretty well documented.
And theological, intellectual hoops that we jumped through to rationalize him and his leadership and his work surely has consequences today.
Absolutely.
Thought processes for our current leaders.
Now, and this will be short. I mean, what we encounter with people who are engaged in theological training and education in the Mennonite world is that they still respond very defensively to critique about sexual violence. Full stop. We're really struggling with that.
And I'm just letting that settle. And on the topic of education, I think that we definitely need to be requiring both appropriate classes about appropriate pastoral boundaries in any seminaries where we're responsible for educating pastors and church leaders. Because one of the biggest things that we see is pastoral abuse. Mm-hmm. And we need to be requiring specific training on sexualized violence. And if I could give one piece of advice to any person who has someone report sexualized violence to them, it is immediately call an outside advocate. Immediately call your local rape crisis center, immediately call your local trauma counselor, immediately call someone who is not associated with your church or organization or institution and ask them what to do. And I have come across this in my own context. I was in a primarily Mennonite context, and there was a person who was who had been sexually violent, and people asked me to use my expertise, and I said, nope, we need to call someone from outside of our context because we are never the right expert for our own space, for our own experiences. Because if you know the person, it colors the way you're going to respond. Even if you're an expert, even if you're someone who knows to, you know, always believe a survivor and to hold the person accountable, even knowing everything that I know, I called an outside expert so that we could have be told the appropriate response in that context. And that is the number one thing that I would tell everyone, and I know we're reluctant to do it. And we think that outside experts aren't going to understand our context right and aren't, you know, aren't going to understand how very special we are as Anabaptists and Mennonites. And that, you know, we do things better and we do things right, but we need outside experts when it comes to sexualized violence. So I want our seminaries to be training our future pastors and our church leaders to call someone outside of their context immediately when someone reports sexualized violence. It's just too, it's too difficult to respond in your own context appropriately. In addition, you mentioned John Howard Yoder and how that impacts our sort of ongoing theological thought processes and how we respond to these things. And I think it links back to what we were talking about with shame and purity. We want to think of our bodies as these like separate things from us and our separate things from our intellectual thoughts and our theology, and our bodies are just these out of control, like lustful things that can do bad things, while our brain is over here writing really smart intellectual theological thoughts. And so we want to be able to separate. John Howard Yoder, he wrote all these good intellectual theological ethical thoughts, but his body was over here doing bad lustful things. And that's, you know, that's bad, but that doesn't, that's so separate. That's just so separate from what he wrote and what he theorized ethically and theologically. And I just say, to which I just say, no.
No.
No, no, no.
Sorry.
He lives in his body. His body and his thought are connected. And you can, I would argue you can see in his theology the seeds of the mentality that allowed him to engage in dominating and violent sexual behaviors. Mm-hmm. And so I think you can see that play out in other stories of sexualized violence that you might be familiar with in the Mennonite church, where we respond in that same way. You know, we say like, oh, that guy's body did a shameful thing, but he's sorry, and you know, and he's not going to let his body get lustful like that again. I really think, we don't talk about it that concretely, but I really think we try to separate what the lustful body wants to be going and doing, and you know, and what our minds and our souls, how they connect to God. And so, you know, if we're just properly connecting our minds and our souls to God, then our bodies won't do those, you know, bad things. And so we work much more from a like suppression place. It affects how we respond to sexualized violence. It affects how we think about how sexualized violence happens, right? Oh, we're out of control. And that's also sort of just to call back again, like where it attaches to both queer sexuality and women's bodies and women's sexuality. Because that separating of our bodies are sites of sexual shame that need to be controlled by our minds and our relationship with God. That really impacts the ways that we think about women and that we think about queer folks in the church and that we think about sexualized violence. Mm-hmm. Okay, I got all excited, so you can rein us back in if you want.
Important points, because if these issues are affecting our theology, they're obviously affecting our lives with each other, but they're also affecting our relationship with God and our understanding of who God is and our relationship with God, and that has implications as well.
Hey everyone, this is Paul Walker. If you like what you just heard, be sure to check out more of what we have to offer at menonerds.com. It's the hub for all things menonerds. From there, you can learn more about these podcasts, syndicated blogs from people all over the world, books authored by some of our members, and a host of other exciting free resources for you and your church. Now, there's one last thing. What we do costs a bit of money, and we're always doing it on a volunteer basis. We have people that are committed to making this happen, but we could use more people. If you like what we do, please consider donating monthly. We have two options. You can either do a monthly donation through Patreon, or you can give a one-time donation at any time through PayPal. We love the work we do, but we do need your help to keep it going and to expand into new territory. If you would like to donate, check out menonerds.com/donate. Thanks for listening, and as always, have a great day.